Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Donald Trump first won tabloid fame as a brash bachelor real estate developer in New York City. He made a seamless transition to television personality, less self-made than self-invented. Not so much the corporate success story of The Apprentice than a cardboard version of a tycoon. And a cartoonish, cruel one at that, inspired by professional wrestling, reality TV, and antiheroes as The Sopranos, Mad Men, and Breaking Bad. So argues the New York Times' chief television critic in a new book. This hour on Point, my conversation with James Poniewozik about President Trump, television, and the fracturing of America. Join us. How are your impressions of Trump affected over the years by seeing him on TV before his presidency? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Kansas City, everything's up to date with James Poniewozik. He is chief television critic of the New York Times, author of the new book Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. You can link to an excerpt at onpointradio.org. James, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, David.
You are out there talking to Americans about your book, about their president, about his pre-presidential days. As you think about this and through the lens of television, you know, what characters would you say have inspired the persona of Donald Trump?
You know, I think that you see a little bit of a lot of people in Donald Trump. I see some Archie Bunker in the way he presents himself. I'm not the only one who sees that. Famously, Steve Bannon, one of his big boosters, once referred to him as, dude, he's Archie Bunker.
Just a sentence of who Archie Bunker was.
Oh, so that was Norman Lear's funny, lovable, irascible bigot on All in the Family. I'd sing you a few bars of Those Were the Days, but I don't want to subject your listeners to that. There are elements of Tony Soprano in him, you know, this sort of hard-charging alpha male who, you know, you may not necessarily like all his methods, but he gets the job done. There are elements of Donald Trump, the reality TV figure on The Apprentice in him, you know, which was a performance just like any other on television. And that itself was informed by a lot of other sort of, you know, brash, trash-talking, getting real figures on other reality TV. He really folds in a lot of things into this performance, and this performance has been going on even well before The Apprentice, going back to the 80s when he was a ubiquitous media figure and sort of this, you know, Reagan-era cartoon representation of wealth living on top of a golden tower and getting parodied on Saturday Night Live as far back as the late 80s. In a way, all of television, or at least a lot of television, kind of merges in him. Even television that he, you know, did not necessarily watch himself. An interesting thing about Donald Trump is that as much as he's a creature of television, I don't see much evidence that he watches a lot of, say, scripted dramas, mm-hmm. you know. And yet, this is part of the argument of the book. One thing that television does is that it introduces these sort of archetypes and themes into the culture. Even among people who don't necessarily watch, they become part of this, you know, kind of cultural material from which a leader can form a persona.
So let's take listeners back. Some of them will be reintroduced. Some of them will hear some of these things for the very first time. But, you know, he, you know, it's almost as though, you know, his Naiku unit was bathed in television Klieg lights, right? You know, like he was a guy who, yeah, in some ways unfolded first in the tabloid pages of New York City and then in television lights. So according to my guest, James Poniewozik, Donald Trump, the television character, was born on August 21st, 1980. And that's when Tom Brokaw, not yet NBC's nightly news anchor, introduced viewers of the Today Show and the nation to a personality who'd been making noise in the New York City real estate business.
Trying to scrape up a down payment for a little fixer-upper in your neighborhood? Take a look at my next guest. There's a report around Wall Street that this is what he has in mind. This is Donald Trump, 33 years old. And some people think that he wants to buy the World Trade Center, the 110-story Manhattan skyscraper that anyone can pick up if they've got the coins. Donald Trump, as I say, is just 33 years old.
Now, Poniewozik notes in his book that Trump was actually 34 during that interview. The interview went on, and when asked if he wanted to become a billionaire, here's what Trump said near the conclusion of that 1980 interview with Tom Brokaw on the Today Show.
No, I really don't. I just want to keep busy and keep active and be interested in what I do, and that's all there is to life as far as I'm concerned. I really am not looking to make tremendous amounts of money. I'm looking to enjoy my life, and if that happens to go with it, that's fabulous.
James Poniewozik, listening back to the excerpts of that interview, what insights do you derive about who Donald Trump really was and who he wanted us to think he was at that time?
You know, I think that that interview is fascinating on a lot of levels, you know, number one of which is just, you know, an auditory level. You listen to him, that sounds like a different sort of Donald Trump than the one that we are used to, you know, coming out of all our screens and speakers today. It's a much more mellifluous, sort of soft-spoken Trump, more ingratiating, more calming. And part of the subject of the book is that what you're hearing in part is the sort of voice of media at the time, that Donald Trump was coming up and trying to establish himself as a media celebrity in an era in which, you know, we didn't have the fragmented niche media of today, but you had a sort of three-network television mass medium in which things had to appeal to much broader audiences, and your self-presentation had to appeal to a broader audience. So it's sort of a, you know, the softer side of the Trump that we would see later. You know, it's still sort of, you know, presenting himself as an ambitious young man with big plans, but in a way that is more broadly palatable than the version of himself that you know that we see nowadays.
You know, it's interesting because reporters like Tim O'Brien and David Farenthold and others have documented the question about, you know, he's asked by Brokaw whether or not he wants to be a billionaire, right? And he demurs and whatever. So, of course, Trump since then has insisted that he's a billionaire many, many times over, and probably to great multiplication of what the facts actually are, which are really are
yes.
In doubt as to whether or not he hit that billion mark. Not that it should matter fundamentally, but that it clearly matters to him. There's another NBC.
Oh, it matters hugely to him. Yeah. I'm sorry. It mattered hugely to him at the time. And one thing that's sort of interesting was that part of the reason he's on the Today Show is that he was already building this presence as a New York City tabloid figure. And the tabloid reporters at the time, you know, recalled later that, oh, he was great. You could talk to him. He would give you gossip and give you great items for your column. And the only thing he cared about was that you called him a billionaire, you know, whether he was not. Because, you know, the idea of creating this presentation, of understanding how ideas redound in the media, all that matters is that people are hearing Donald Trump billionaire, Donald Trump billionaire. And if that repeats over and over and long enough, it becomes their reality. So I'm sorry. Go ahead, though.
No, that's all right. There was another interview done by NBC, interestingly taped before the Brokaw interview, but televised later, in which Trump, then I guess 34, explains to NBC's Rona Barrett why he didn't believe someone like him could possibly be elected president. This broadcast was also aired in 1980.
Somebody with the kind of views that are maybe a little bit unpopular, which may be right, but maybe unpopular, wouldn't necessarily have a chance of getting elected against somebody with no great brain but a big smile. And that's a sad commentary for the political process.
Television, in a strange way, has ruined that process, hasn't it?
It's hurt the process very much. I mean, the Abraham Lincolns of the world. Abraham Lincoln would probably not be electable today because of television.
My producer, Adam Waller, is correcting me slightly. That portion of the interview didn't make it to air in NBC in a primetime special, but it surfaced instead on YouTube decades later. Again, he's demurring. What does it tell us about his conception of television, and how sincere do you think he thinks he's being at that time?
You know, I think the very interesting thing about what he's saying there is that he is making this point that in the television, you know, in the television environment of his day, a sort of brash, maybe controversial figure couldn't necessarily get elected. And the thing is, I think he was very much right. It was very important, again, in this mass media era, to present, to be less polarizing, to sort of sand down your edges. This was 1980. There was a presidential election going on at the time. Jimmy Carter was running against Ronald Reagan. We all remember now that Ronald Reagan won in a landslide, but what, you know, you maybe not remember is that at the time, there were concerns about Ronald Reagan. Was he too belligerent? Was he too warlike? You know, could America feel safe with him? And one reason that Donald Trump was able to get him elected was, you know, being an actor, being a great performer, being able to present a palatable version of himself on television. He came across in debates and in his TV appearances as, you know, sort of avuncular and good humored and relaxing, and set people at ease with him. Now, you go from that to today. You go from that to when Donald Trump ran for president and announced his run on Fox and Friends and was asked sort of a version of the same question. He responded, well, I don't think this is going to be an election based on real popularity. And I think also by 2015, that also turned out to be true. And that sort of set the frame for my book, which is explaining, you know, one piece of how is it that we got as a culture, as a society, as a political entity from that point back in 1980 to the present day, when there's a very different reality in what kinds of characters are rewarded in the media.
And an expansion from a broadcast world to – or narrowing, I should say, to a niche cable world. You know, we will talk a little bit more about this, but Trump, of course, had not only absorbed television but had his imprint upon it. By the 1990s, Donald Trump had made a cultural leap into the country's consciousness by did so with a lot of cameos in movies and TV shows. Here's a montage of Trump's appearances that were put together by my colleagues at NPR's Morning Edition.
Waldo, you're the best son money can buy.
It's the Donald! Oh, my God!
Samantha, a cosmopolitan, and Donald Trump. You just don't get more New York than that.
Donald Trump, I'd like you to meet... Oh, what am I talking about? All you handsome zillionaires know each other.
That's from the French Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Sex and the City, and The Nanny. We'll be talking about all this and more. Donald Trump's influence on television, its influence on him. Join our conversation. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing Donald Trump and television, a match seemingly made in cultural heaven. You can join the conversation for people who watched The Apprentice or Celebrity Apprentice. How did that affect how you viewed the president? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, James Poniewozik, chief television critic of The New York Times and author of the brand new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. I have a call I want to quickly take, and we have a number of calls we will take in coming minutes. But first, I want to take one from Baltimore, Maryland. John, thanks for listening. What are your thoughts on this?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I grew up in New York City. I'm 35, I was born in 84, so I didn't get to experience the real estate mogul. I only experienced Trump as a cameo, like punchline. You know, I think the first time I ever saw him was either Home Alone or the
Home Alone 2, right?
Home Alone 2 or Muppet Take Manhattan. And where, like, it just seemed like he was willing to always, like, oh yeah, I'm the rich guy, you know, like, like just making jokes about that. And then, and the celebrity and The Apprentice, it seems like the caricature that he was playing to try to gain popularity that your guest was speaking about earlier, like you tell a lie often enough and you start to believe it yourself that it's true. Like it seems like the caricature that he was playing became who he thought he was and the snake ate its own tail, so to speak. So it's not
That's awesome.
Just an observation. I want to see if the guest agrees with me.
John, thanks for that. James Poniewozik, a little cultural Ouroboros there from Baltimore. Tell us, we'll get to The Apprentice in a minute or two, but tell us a little bit about the idea of the person becoming the caricature and the reason he was willing to be that sort of cultural figure in Home Alone 2 and in The Muppets Take Manhattan and pretty much almost anybody willing to offer him a brief slot in a movie. James Poniewozik, have we lost you, sir? Well, tell you what, let's take a couple of calls and try to get him back from Kansas City, Missouri. Linda is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts about Trump as a reality TV star.
I didn't like him as a reality TV star. I definitely do not like him as a president. I feel that he has no respect for women. He has no respect for the common person. The only thing I see that he respects is himself, money, and power.
So how do you get that from television as opposed to what you've been seeing in recent years as your feelings about him as a candidate and as a politician?
I didn't really watch The Apprentice very much, but I didn't see – I'm in education. I think respect is key. And reality television, the people on there have no respect for anyone. And I think that's a big part of the problem that we have today and for the last however many years.
Well, thank you so much, Linda, for that. Why don't we play a clip now for you about reality TV, get a little bit of what Linda was calling about. Trump's rise as a cultural force propelled, of course, by emergency reality TV shows. There were shows like Survivor that encouraged participants to compete by taking not so subtle jabs at each other. The phrase I always remember is, I didn't come here to make friends, right? Trump starred in his own incarnation of the genre for 11 years as the seeming overlord of the corporate boardroom in the NBC show The Apprentice. Here's part of the program's opening from 2004.
I've mastered the art of the deal and have turned the name Trump into the highest quality brand. And as the master, I want to pass along my knowledge to somebody else. I'm looking for The Apprentice.
James Poniewozik, welcome back. Tell us, how much of what Trump was doing there was playing a role? How closely or in what way was it linked to the reality of his actual life?
It was an embellished version of his actual life. In other words, that introduction he gives at the beginning of The Apprentice is sort of cribbed from his 1997 book, The Art of the Comeback, which was sort of one of the sequels to The Art of the Deal, where he mythologizes this era, that you were talking about during the 90s when his businesses went bankrupt and he ends up sort of playing a parodic version of himself in sitcoms in order to keep his brand alive, and retells it in a way where it's like he is the phoenix rising from the ashes. Now, what he ends up doing is he uses what I think he has called in the past truthful hyperbole, right? He refers to owning a lot of business operations that he no longer owned at the time, because at that point, his business had become the brand and licensing the name to other people. And in fact, that is, something to which playing a character is essential, right? Because, just to back up a slight bit, when he ran into business troubles at the beginning of the 90s, part of the reason that it's valuable to him to go on Home Alone 2 and The Fresh Prince and so on is that one needs to sort of, reinforce this, to use this character that sends the message out into the public consciousness that Donald Trump is, your go-to idea of a rich guy. He symbolizes, he owns the corner of your brain that is the symbolic center for rich person. And that is very valuable. if, you know, your whole enterprise is about celebrity and branding and leveraging a brand for success. And what he was then able to do was get basically syndicate that brand to a very valuable partner, which was Mark Burnett, formerly the producer of Survivor, then producer of The Apprentice, who needed somebody, you know, he needed a symbol to put into his reality show, which are highly symbolic productions, so that, you know, you would see him and you would think, okay, this show is about wealth and luxury and success. And Donald Trump had been building that sort of cartoon, that collection of symbols for a couple of decades at that point. And it made him perfect for reality TV because he had been reality TV before reality TV existed.
You know, there's something else that you mentioned in your book, which I had registered but not thought about in the way you present it. You spend a lot of time talking about, you know, sort of how the gold leaf, you know, the little thinnest of veneers of gold presented and projected this sense of incredible wealth, but that the actual thinness of the gold in some ways is taken to be more real than actual gold would be. You then talk about how the presentation of him as the embodiment of a billionaire, of a ruthless tycoon, of a brilliant real estate mogul was really important not only for him, but ultimately when some of his businesses went belly up or when he was about to default on loans to his creditors, to the banks that loaned him money, they couldn't really go hard and expose him as making terrible decisions or bad bets, because then they might not get their money back, right? They wouldn't recoup it. So they were as invested in that image as he was, it seemed to me.
Part of the secret of Donald Trump's success, the story of his life over and over again, has been getting partners who are so invested in the illusion of him that they have no choice but to help to maintain it. And, you know, as you say, when he went bust in the early 90s, end of the 80s, he gets put on this budget by his creditors. I think it was something like $450,000 a month, you know, see if you can get by on that. Basically, he's being paid to be a rich guy because, you know, the business of, you know,
at a time of financial collapse, he's being paid to be a rich guy, right?
Yes, exactly. And it was literally to keep up appearances because appearances were his main product. I say in the book that Donald Trump was sort of an intuitive postmodernist. Like he had a great notion for this idea that the simulacrum of a thing, the impression of a thing, the symbol of a thing, was more powerful in a heavily mediated culture than the thing itself. So, and that's why, yes, he associates things. You know, there is so much. You know, there are so many signifiers if you look at Trump Tower of you know, images of gold or brass that looks like gold, because gold is this ancient symbol in people's minds that they equate with wealth. And, you know, when you get to Trump in the 1990s and the relationship of keeping his brand alive for the creditors, it literally becomes a situation where the idea of Donald Trump, the character of Donald Trump, has to save the actual Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to take a call now from St. Petersburg, Florida. John, thanks for listening. Your thoughts here?
Yes, I was just saying, thinking to myself, he reminds me of Ronald Reagan. He's just an actor playing a president, not an actual president, an actor playing one. Mm-hmm. So he has no policies. He has nothing other than to wing it. So he's ad-libbing the entire presidency, much like I think Ronald Reagan did.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Let me throw that back to James Poniewozik. You know, you mentioned Reagan a few minutes ago. You mentioned him in the book.
Yeah.
You know, I'm Californian. It strikes me, I remember the 80s and a lot of liberals, you know, sort of sneered at Reagan for, you know, policies, but also from his background. Here is the co-star from Bedtime for Bonzo. You know, this is ridiculous. He was also not only a guy who had gone all over the nation as a paid spokesman for GE talking about public policy, but he was the two-time governor of California. I mean, that counts for something, right? Like he almost knocked off Gerald Ford in 76. He was an accomplished politician. Like is there a difference there, or am I overlooking the similarities that are important to register?
No, I think there's a difference. Your caller makes a good point, which, you know, I agree with to an extent, but I think that the differences are very interesting. Number one, as you say, you know, sort of on the surface level, Ronald Reagan actually had to enter politics and be governor of California before he could go, you know, on to the office of the presidency. Donald Trump did this entirely through the media. His last episode of The Celebrity Apprentice aired, I think it was exactly 4 months before he began his first successful campaign for the presidency. So he established media and celebrity as a direct route to the presidency. You know, so that's one key difference that shows how things change. A second thing is that Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump were both performers. They were both entertainers. But there's a significant and revealing difference in the kind of entertainer they were. Ronald Reagan was a movie actor. What do actors have to do? Actors have to believe in the reality and the interiority of other people. They have to have,
you know, why don't you explain what that means?
Meaning that, you know, accepting that other people and trying to understand the inner mental states of other people. To an actor has to believe, an actor has to really cultivate empathy. Because you have to, your job is to imagine yourself as somebody other than yourself. You have to make yourself believe that a character that you're reading on a page that doesn't even exist is as real as you are. And Ronald Reagan had said that, you know, that equipped him for a lot of the demands of the presidency, and he didn't entirely understand how somebody could be president without that. Now, Donald Trump, to segue us forward to The Apprentice, he was also, you know, quote-unquote, playing a character, giving a public performance. But playing a character in reality TV is a very different thing. Playing a character in reality TV, you are being yourself, but you are being an exaggerated, heightened version of yourself. You're being yourself, but more. You're isolating those parts of yourself that get the most attention, that are the most provocative and outrageous and keep the camera light on you. And you are really, you know, more focused about on projecting that than you are in understanding the, you know, sort of reality and validity of the other people around you, except, you know, sort of as objects or obstacles that you have to deal with. So it's almost a kind of, you know, anti-empathy that it cultivates. And if you have success at that, if you have a successful reality show, it pushes you, you know, you're being rewarded for it. So it pushes you to be a more and more extreme version of yourself. And, you know, you saw that arc develop with Donald Trump.
Sounds like if we were, you know, in the business of developing that very characteristic, we'd say that America is running an empathy gap at the moment, at least in the characterizations we're drawing from this. I want to take a call from Newmarket, Virginia. Steve, thanks for listening. Your thoughts?
Hi. My father was a World War II vet and a taciturn guy, kept his opinions to himself. He didn't watch a lot of television. He was in a senior citizen's high-rise, and we go down there when The Apprentice is on. And we turn it on, and my father says, "Hey, you know what? I'm not watching that." I said, "Why not?" He says, "Because that's a con man," which is rare for my father. So he knew enough about things to have known about Donald Trump, but he somehow knew this, and his friends knew it, too, without even – I mean, they just saw this guy. So that's my story, and I just wanted to tell you that. So have a good one.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks for listening. James Poniewozik, I want to turn in the last few minutes of this segment to another form of television from which you argue that he draws inspiration. Let's take Tony Soprano and Walter White, two exemplars of a relatively recent development in television, the emergence of the anti-hero as protagonist. And that's a lead character whose moral compass is askew, but whom you root for in spite of or because of that. Here's a taste of what that sounds like from both The Sopranos and Breaking Bad.
By the time I was a kid, I knew I'd run a family business.
What line of work are you in?
Waste management consultant.
It's a gift from Tony Soprano.
Are you in the mafia?
This is overdue. Am I in the what? Like my uncle ran it. Like my father ran it.
I'm thinking maybe you and I could partner up.
You want to cook crystal meth? You.
Doctor, my wife is 7 months pregnant with a baby we didn't intend. My 15-year-old son has cerebral palsy. I am an extremely overqualified high school chemistry teacher.
James Poniewozik, you are an extremely qualified TV critic. We got about a minute and a half before this particular segment breaks. Just give us a taste of why you think Trump was influenced by the rise of sort of the cable prestige show antihero.
Number one, because this kind of introduces this idea that didn't exist in the early days of television, that you could, kind of back or support a character who may be not be, you know, an upstanding guy in the traditional moral sense, but gets the job done, understands that it's an ugly world and you got to be an ugly person to survive in it sometimes. And also, you know, this was a kind of character that also bled over into reality TV. A lot of the stars of reality TV, whether it was Richard Hatch in the first season of Survivor or, you know, Simon Cowell on American Idol, those were forms of anti-heroes themselves. You know, the person who's not polite, who doesn't always follow the rules, but they're so entertaining that you just go along for the ride. And that is, you know, that can be a very powerful argument, a very powerful kind of, template for somebody who wants to sell themselves as a political figure that way.
So you're seeing him as a guy who's sort of absorbing that in the ethos, even if he's not that close a watcher of these complicated shows. We're discussing the evolution of TV and the ascendance of Donald Trump with James Poniewozik. You can join our conversation. What TV appearances by Donald Trump do you recall most vividly? We'll take submissions all the way back to the 80s. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the influence that TV has played in shaping the 45th president of the United States. That would, of course, be one Donald J. Trump. Feel free to join our conversation. We want to hear from you if you've had a positive impression of Donald Trump taken from what you've seen of him on television. Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me this hour, James Poniewozik, chief television critic for The New York Times and author of the new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. Here are a few calls I'd like to take from listeners. Thanks for listening. Augusta, Georgia, Anna's calling in. Anna, what are your thoughts?
Well, I called before you said positive, so I've been on hold a minute. but I just wanted to say that it's all an image, it's all a facade, and that name recognition is so important now to the American voters that people of substance, people who have a message, people who have a vision, are being overshadowed by name recognition. This whole facade, this whole characterization that we have of number 45 is nothing more than pandering to the media, which he says is the evil, the enemy of the people.
Sure.
Yes,
thanks for that.
Enemy of the people.
Thanks for that, Anna. I appreciate it. I want to also take a call from Mary, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Mary, thanks for weighing in.
Hi. I think the only positive thing that I can come to a realization with him is that you get a glimpse of how he really is with regard to loyalty and how he treated the team on his television show. I wasn't a regular watcher because I'm not a big fan. And I think he portrayed himself as a very rich used car salesman on this show. And I don't think he has the business acumen to figure out who's the best.
All right. Thank you for that, Mary. I appreciate it. I want to take one more call now from Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, thanks for listening. Tell us what you're thinking.
Hi, David. Thank you. P.T. Barnum, later of Ringling, Barnum and Bailey, Circus, famously said, "A sucker is born every minute." Now, P.T. Barnum started with a museum of curiosities in New York City, and it was full of fake stuff, and people knew that when they went and paid admission to get in. P.T. Barnum was the king of hoaxes, and he capitalized on it. It was all fake, it was all delusion, and it was pure entertainment, and that is exactly what number 45 is up to.
Thanks for your call and your impressions of that, Claire. Appreciate it. James Poniewozik, the callers this hour have been, fairly unimpressed by the president, those that saw him on reality TV shows, those that did not. We certainly have plenty of Trump advocates who listen to the show who have called in. I wanted to point your attention to a critique offered by my NPR colleague Annalisa Quinn. She's admiring of both your criticism and of your book, but she says at one point, "The book's largest admission is a serious consideration of Trump's supporters. You can easily see how Trump's belligerent, spiteful performances might get him attention. What happens in that small, crucial distance between attention and support? It might be hard to write a book that accounts for both sides of the equation." But, she basically says, in a sense, where is the empathy and understanding, not sympathy, but empathy and insight into why people would convert this 100% name recognition into not majority support, but close to a majority of support that Trump enjoyed in 2016.
I've seen that criticism, and I understand it. I mean, I made a choice in the book not to try to too deeply analyze sort of the path of the Trump voter and the populist movement in America, which I think is a subject for a fascinating book and a different book, and that I feared would sort of devolve into armchair sociology in this. But I do think that there is a fair amount of the book that engages with the audience that ultimately, and obviously presidential election, the presidential elections are involve coalitions, but that eventually developed into Donald Trump's most intense base. I think in part that was the Fox News base, or at least it was a base that he eventually, once he became a Fox News personality, having become a reality TV personality, he sort of formed a bond with and gave a more satisfying version of the red meat that they were used to getting from Fox, and sort of co-opted, kind of made this audience that Roger Ailes had developed into a conservative force over a couple of decades into his captive audience, But I think that there there are a lot of reasons that one could be drawn to Trump's persona. The Apprentice did a lot to burnish his image. It wasn't, simply "you're fired," although "you're fired" had a lot to do with that. It also, would often present him as, sort of warm and generous and, had a sense of humor and could, be encouraging to people as well as firing them. This is borrowing a bit of a psychological term, but there is a term that is used in this study that's called a parasocial bond, which is the bond that people form with characters or personas that they see on television week after week, because our minds basically, our brains are not evolved to distinguish virtual relationships from real ones. In other words, once somebody's coming into your living room week after week after week after week, you feel you know them, even if you know on some level that what you're seeing is an artifice and is a show. I think that's a part of it.
And, you write in the book how you enjoy reality TV show, but you don't buy that people don't know what they're getting. You think people get what they're getting as an artifice and still are sort of enjoying it on multiple levels, tapping into it. One of the things that's interesting about it is you talk about getting to know somebody week after week. NBC, in order to promote the show, used to interview him routinely on the Today Show, right, as a way of kind of elevating and promoting their – their important primetime entertainment vehicles, their money vehicles, let's be honest. But – Additionally, in 2011, you talk about Roger Ailes, the founding CEO and then chairman of Fox News before his ouster and scandal and then his death. Trump started making weekly appearances on the cable news morning show Fox and Friends beginning in 2011. And you write that, that sort of transitioned him from an entertainment figure to a political figure. Here's a clip of Trump from 8 years ago commenting on what he'd fix about the country.
When you look at what the world is doing to us. They don't respect us. They don't respect our leaders. They certainly don't respect Obama. When you look at what's happening on the outside in, meaning what China's doing, what OPEC's doing, what many other countries are doing to us, where you call up about a credit card and you're calling India because they outsource so many jobs. You look at our unemployment, you look at our lack of jobs, our lack of good jobs and real jobs. A lot of things can be done to reduce that deficit, and I mean really quickly.
All right. Well, you might know something about that because you've been doing that your whole life.
That was the voice of Gretchen Carlson there saying something that not entirely true, given the number of his businesses that went bankrupt at various points or declared bankruptcy at various points. But nonetheless, Trump was taken seriously on Fox and Friends as he had been on the Today Show on NBC, as somebody weighing in on political things. But my sense, James Poniewozik, is that the key theme, other than his familiarity with viewers, that connected him with them was not a question of deficit busting, right? Like what issues, what themes that he stressed really seemed to cement him with the Fox viewer?
I mean, I think it's a lot about tone and worldview. You know, going back to that first clip you played for us of Donald Trump in 1980 on the Today Show with Tom Brokaw, the softer Donald Trump. This is a very different sounding guy you're hearing here. It's punchy. It's pugilistic. It's angry and emphasizing these things about here. We're being cheated. We're being ripped off. And it plays into this character that, you know, is developed over the years and kind of, you know, comes out in full on The Apprentice of, you know, Donald Trump, fighter guy who's going to fight for you. You know, we're being taken advantage of and he's going to hit back. And it's being validated through this forum where, which is, you know, a news program. It's a way of transitioning somebody who is mostly an entertainment figure and turning him into a sage political commentator. And through him, Fox, you know, the Fox News audience is hearing a version of, you know, the various grievances and complaints that have been fomented through opinion posts on Fox for year after year after year. And they're hearing it come from a charismatic celebrity that they're familiar with from TV. And it's tremendously exciting.
How important, you know, you write and mention Trump's rhetoric about race. How important was birtherism to his popularity on Fox, and how important was Fox to his stressing the question of birtherism?
I think that birtherism was very important to his forming that bond with a particular segment of the base that was, you know, outraged in the Obama years, angry at Obama, and that, you know, there was a racist tinge to their suspicion of them, because that's where birtherism came from. Now, interestingly enough, he did not first surface that on Fox News. He surfaced that through his Twitter account, which, you know, he was developing his Twitter persona basically at the same time. It's kind of an operation running in tandem with his appearances on Fox News. But once that becomes a controversy, then it becomes a thing that needs to be covered in the news. And it was really Donald Trump who got birtherism to be raised as a subject on Fox News. And even if, you know, many conservatives at the time didn't really want to touch that, well, it resonated with a lot of the audience. And it's a way, you know, it is a way of saying to them, you know, I wholly believe what you believe. I share your anger. I share your outrage and your suspicions. And, you know, I'm out here saying the things that, you know, you wish that more people were out there saying. So, you know, as ugly and ultimately disproven as it was, that was pretty valuable to him. It was a bonding experience.
James Poniewozik, you allude to a number of pop cultural figures that inspire Trump intentionally, perhaps unconsciously, you refer, among other things, to the 1980 comedy movie classic Caddyshack. Now, you've described how he plays the role of this cartoon. He's almost like the personification of whatever Moneybags, Uncle Moneybags is from Monopoly, right? But in Caddyshack, yeah. You know, there's this guy who's isn't smooth. He's not wearing a perfect suit. He doesn't have all the elegance or the aspirations to that in a way that one might immediately recognize. In the scene from the clip involving the clip I'm about to play, there's a brash real estate developer portrayed by Rodney Dangerfield who challenges the button-down founder of the Bushwick Country Club to hit his golf ball straight. Ted Knight plays the outraged golfer.
Let's go while we're young.
You mind, sir? Trying to tee off?
I bet you slice into the woods $100.
Gambling is illegal at Bushwood, sir, and I never slice.
Damn! Okay, you can owe me.
I owe you nothing.
So in the book, James Poniewozik writes that the Dangerfield's character, quote, wears ridiculous loud jackets rather than the judge's ridiculous preppy nautical wear. This particular archetype of wealth especially served Trump later, particularly in the 2016 Republican primary when he essentially ran as Al Cervic. Why the Caddyshack role? What commends that to your attention for Trump?
Because, you know, that Rodney Dangerfield character, Al Cervic, he's like a fantasy of, you know, that's what I'd like to be like if I were a rich person. I'd be rich and I'd have more money than the other rich people, but I wouldn't have to change who I essentially am. I don't have to follow their stuffed shirt rules and their politenesses and their proprieties. And that, too, you know, that is very much the character that Trump particularly played in the 2016 Republican primary. And it is a way of sort of, you know, presenting a character of yourself as a rich guy, but a rich guy of the people, making it an asset for you. And I don't know, you know, 2012 seems like a long time ago now. But, you know, remember when Mitt Romney ran and being a rich businessman was often very much a liability for him. Well, you know, with Donald Trump, he sent in a story like Caddyshack, there's sort of this dichotomy. The Ted Knight character is the rich guy that everybody hates. You mm-hmm. know, he's prim and proper and judgmental. And you know, you like the guy who is rich but rude and doesn't care what he says. And in fact, Donald Trump had, you know, a run-in with Mitt Romney during the 2016
sure,
Republican primary, where Mitt Romney is, you know, like this man is, you know, not of our type and he's going to besmirch the party and America will no longer be a shining city on the hill. And Donald Trump's response, it was just, you know, pure Rodney Dangerfield. He's like, back when Mitt Romney was running for president, he came to me and begged for my endorsement. I could have told him to get down on his knees and he would have got down on his knees, you know, and That was when I realized that, you know, Al Cervic had just driven his speedboat into the 2016 election.
Before we relinquish James Poniewozik, I want to play a brief clip which reminds us that not only did the president become formed by TV, but it has informed his presidency as well in some ways. Think about reality television when you listen to this clip. In June 2017, President Trump assembled his full cabinet for a televised meeting in which each member went around the table to share their thoughts about the 45th president.
Thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda and the American people. And
Mr. President, it's been a great honor to work with you. Thank you for your strong support of HUD.
Thank you, Mr. President. It was a great honor traveling with you around the country for the last year, and an even greater honor to be here serving in your cabinet.
Take us out, James Poniewozik, with the thought, how closely does this resemble a Celebrity Apprentice or the like?
That was an Apprentice boardroom. I mean, if you've watched any episodes of The Apprentice, you're familiar with the session when, you know, the team that loses goes in and the characters go around and there's always this element of sucking up to Mr. Trump because you don't want to get fired. So it's, you know, Mr. Trump, I read The Art of the Deal and I've patterned myself on you all my life. And here it was playing out in the White House.
I'd say the same about you, James Poniewozik, chief television critic of The New York Times, author of the new book, Audience of One, Donald Trump Television, and the Fracturing of America. Great to have you with us.
Thanks a lot, David.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I want to thank the hardest working team on public radio. Our executive producer is Karen Shipman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Mm-hmm. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.